Good morning, I'm Bob Carty, and you're listening to the Friday edition of The Current. In our last half hour, we'll hear memories of the military junta that terrorized Argentina for 7 years. And we'll talk about how the legacy of that dirty war is linked to the political and economic uncertainty that seems to plague Argentina today. But first, the links between environmental health and human disease. A few weeks ago, the CBC's Wendy Mesley appeared on The Current to tell us about the questions she began asking herself during her own battle with breast cancer. Questions like, why do people with a seemingly healthy lifestyle get cancer? What role does a polluted environment play in causing cancer? And why isn't more work being done to understand the environmental causes of that disease? Well, we were flooded with mail from other cancer survivors and their loved ones, all expressing similar frustration and confusion over diagnoses that seem to come out of the blue. Award-winning cancer researcher Federica Pereira has been working for decades to shed light on the connections between the environment that people live in and how that affects their risk of getting cancer. Dr. Pereira has been billed as a DNA damage detective. She teaches environmental health at Columbia University and is the director of the Columbia Center for Children's Environmental Health. And Dr. Pereira joins me now from our New York studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Pleasure to have you with us.
Pleasure.
So often, Dr. Pereira, the focus of preventative medicine seems to be about our lifestyle choices, what we drink, what we smoke, and what we don't. But to your mind, how much of our attention should be focused on the environment?
Well, I think lifestyle is very, very important, obviously. But a somewhat neglected area has been other environmental exposures that come to us through the air we breathe, the food we eat, the water we drink. And I think both are very, very important. In terms of the actual impact on cancer rates, smoking is, of course, the number one cause of cancer, environmental cause of cancer. But there is also an effect of sidestream smoke, that is passive smoking by non-smokers.
Which is environmental in a sense.
Of course, yes. All of these things we put in the box environmental. So lifestyle-related exposures, drinking, smoking, and the pollutants that I mentioned in the ambient environment, in the indoor environment, and in the workplace, all those things are referred to as environmental.
So we're talking about pesticides, smog, all those things?
Exactly. And we have focused quite a lot on air pollutants that come from combustion of fossil fuels, for example, pollutants coming out of tailpipes of cars, buses, trucks, out of smokestacks, burning coal. So fossil fuel is a major source of these pollutants.
And how did you get into this work on environmental causes of cancer? How did that start and when?
Well, it started when I was looking at the risks of air pollution and was very, very frustrated just reviewing what was in the literature from epidemiologic studies, which were studying, asking people who had cancer, can you remember what you were exposed to or where you lived 20 or 30 years before? And then trying to put that information together with the type of cancer that was diagnosed much later. And there are all kinds of problems with those studies, but they were suggesting that there were effects of environmental pollutants, including air pollution. And in the meantime, I started this work in the 80s, and in the previous 10 years, there'd been a real explosion of knowledge in molecular biology, which was telling us about the process of carcinogenesis, that is the process by which cancer is caused, and the steps in that process, and had developed methods to actually measure those in the laboratory, in the test tube or in experimental animals. And I thought, why not bring those methods out of the laboratory and apply them within population studies.
Okay, so I want to talk about one of your studies in that area, because I think that maybe will help us understand what can be difficult science.
Yes.
You're working on something called the Mothers and Newborns Study. Tell us about that.
That's right. So after years of working on adult cancer and thinking about the problems of environmental exposure and seeing that as we studied younger and younger populations, we were continuing to see markers, that is, early signs of damage that is on the pathway, the carcinogenic pathway, in young children. And then I once looked at a series of blood samples from, they were umbilical cord blood samples, and I thought these will be very clean and pristine, right? They actually weren't. Mm. It showed me, showed us that there were exposures occurring in the womb that were having, they were damaging DNA with possible implications for cancer later in life, in childhood or even in adulthood. And that really made me think that we needed to focus on this really understudied window of susceptibility, the fetal development period.
And hence the Mothers and Newborns Study.
Hence this study.
And what do you do?
Well, I can take you through it
briefly.
Very briefly, from the time that we recruit women in the prenatal clinics of hospitals in northern Manhattan. The woman is enrolled and invited to join the study, and she's monitored during pregnancy with a small air monitor. It's in a very cute little backpack that she keeps with her during this monitoring period.
So you know what she's breathing in.
So
now
we know what she's breathing in, and therefore we know what the baby is being exposed to, because we know that a certain proportion of the pollutants that the mother's breathing in are able to cross the placenta. Then when the mother is in labor, she calls our research team and notifies them. And we meet her there at the hospital, and we're there to collect samples of umbilical cord blood and other biologic specimens from the mother and the baby, and then we analyze those in the laboratory for fingerprints of exposure and for this for a type of DNA damage, that is, damage to the genetic material from chemicals in air pollution. We look for pesticides, we look at metals, and we also look at genetic factors and nutritional factors that might modify the susceptibility to those exposures.
And okay, then, so you have all these samples from the mother, from the umbilical cord. What are you finding? What kind of substances are there in being passed on to the children?
Well, we find that quite a few substances. The ones that we are looking at are all, first of all, they're all detectable in the air, that is, the pesticides and the chemicals from in air pollution from combustion. These are called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons.
PAHs is what
PAHs for short. Or as one person referred to them, PAHs.
Okay.
Anyway, PAHs. We find those in virtually all of the air samples from the mothers during pregnancy, and indeed we also find their fingerprints in the blood of the mothers and in the umbilical cord blood of the newborn, of the newborns. And we find, to our chagrin somewhat, that although the placenta is doing its job in scarfing up some of this pollution and reducing the levels to the fetus, and that's been shown in other studies, we see that the levels of DNA damage are actually either as high or somewhat higher in the newborn than they are in the mother. And that is telling us that the fetus is possibly on the order of tenfold more sensitive to this kind of DNA damage than is the mother.
Now, you've mentioned this several times now, DNA damage. Now,
yes.
I think most of us assume we have DNA. The television police series are always talking about our DNA.
Mm-hmm.
But you're talking about not just our genetic makeup sort of predisposing us to certain diseases like cancer, but you're talking about damage to our DNA from chemicals?
That's right.
Well, so the chemicals are changing the DNA.
They're actually able to change the DNA by, as we know, the DNA is making up the genes, and the genes are carrying the hereditary information. In other words, the hereditary information is coded within the DNA, And each time the cells divide, this DNA reproduces itself exactly. But some chemicals, like these PAHs, can cause cancer by latching on to components in DNA. They cause changes in the code, and this change is called a mutation. And this mutation is a critical step in cancer, and if other things happen, then the cells can become cancerous.
So it's not just that we have certain genetic makeups, but that the environment can switch things on and off in our genes?
The environment can change the code, the sequence of DNA, and it can also, these same chemicals and others as well, can change the way DNA works in another way. They don't actually change the code or the sequence, the order of the DNA, but they can actually turn it on or off, turn genes on or off, by leaving a mark called methylation on the gene, which doesn't change the structure, but it does change whether the DNA is or the genes are turned on and off and are actually translated into proteins or not. And if this kind of damage, just as if mutations or this kind of mark, this methylation mark, occur in a gene that is meaningful in terms of cancer or in terms of early development or other diseases, that can have serious consequences. If not, there's no serious result, and that's fine.
Well, I want to understand the consequences there. As I understand you so far, you're finding in newborns chemicals from the environment. You're finding that those chemicals are also changing the DNA of the newborns.
Mm-hmm.
Is that sufficient to say then there's a cause and effect with cancer?
We can't say. First of all, you've said exactly what we can say, is that we have this kind of molecular evidence, molecular within an epidemiologic study. That's why we use the term molecular epidemiology, which is quite a mouthful. But we can't say that this means that this individual, this child, either has cancer or for certain will develop cancer. Our data are all interpreted on a group level. What we can say is that on the group level, these results point to potentially increased risk. And because when we put it together with other studies that we and others have done that have shown that this kind of damage is associated with cancer, with lung cancer, breast cancer, and other cancers as well, we can put all of this evidence together and say that this means that we should be taking more steps to reduce or eliminate whenever we can, but certainly reduce these harmful exposures.
Now, this is an important point, I guess, in terms of public health policy, because mm-hmm. there are those who argue that, if you don't have solid cause and effect conclusions, don't do anything. But you're saying it's the role of doctors, of healthcare policy experts, to actually intervene even shy of having full cause and effect results.
Yes, I think that preventive policy does argue for that, for taking action on the basis of well-validated intermediate markers of risk, of increased risk. Another, we call them biomarkers, biologic marker of increased risk of cancer, is chromosomal abnormalities. And we have also found in our mothers and newborns study that the higher the levels of the air pollutants, the PAHs that are breathed by the mother in pregnancy, the higher the likelihood that there will be changes, aberrations, alterations in chromosomes in the newborn white blood cells. And here again, this doesn't mean that that baby will have cancer, but it does mean that there is a potentially increased risk of cancer as a result of these exposures, because changes in chromosomes, chromosomal abnormalities, are linked in many studies to increased risk of cancer.
Do you think enough attention has been paid by our regulators, our authorities in the health area, to this whole matter of environmental determinants of cancer?
I think in the past, no. I think there's more and more interest in this area. For a while, it looked as if perhaps genes were explaining cancer to such a great extent that we didn't need to worry about other things. Now it looks as if the the impact of genes alone, that is to say, the hard drive, high-risk genes like BRCA1 in breast cancer, that they account for possibly 5 to 10% of human cancer. And the rest of cancer results from the interactions between external factors and genes, along with nutritional factors and other non-genetic ones. Now, this means that more and more attention should be paid to these preventable external exposures, and that's good news. In fact, we can estimate that possibly 50 to 80% of cancers can be prevented if we can identify the external environmental
factor. That's quite a number.
That's quite a number, and it's a great challenge, but there are things we can do.
Do you run into some resistance, though, from healthcare policy experts or the cancer establishment?
I don't hear a great deal of resistance. I think people are very interested in this line of work. As you know, much of cancer research is on the other end, on the early detection and the treatment of cancer. And in the past, the prevention, the early side, has been somewhat neglected. And now there's more and more awareness, I think, that we can do a lot better. And if we start very young, as our studies are showing us, we do need to begin very, very early as in the womb. If we start there to protect individuals from harmful exposures, we can have tremendous benefits. And I'm not just talking about reducing risks of childhood cancer, but adult cancer as well, and also other effects that these very same chemicals can cause. We have also shown in our mother-newborn study that the same combustion products can affect fetal growth and early child development. And so there's tremendous benefits if we take appropriate preventive action.
I was thinking, though, that there must be another factor, and that would be where people live and what their socioeconomic conditions are. Is there a class element to this kind of study?
There is, in the sense that nationwide in the U.S., there's disproportionately higher exposure to pollutants like air pollution, pesticides, lead, in the poorer, underserved communities. I suspect it's the same thing in Canada and other countries as well. And so these are the populations that are most exposed. On the other hand, these pollutants are ubiquitous. They're everywhere, widespread, and air pollution knows no boundaries. And so they do cut across class lines.
I suppose another problem you have in your kind of work is that cancer takes a long time. It doesn't show up right away.
That's right.
Especially, and I guess, with these environmental factors.
Exactly so. And that's precisely why this new approach, molecular epidemiology, developed, because we didn't want to wait until so many people had been exposed that we had statistics on increased number of deaths or increased number of cases, and had to piece it together retrospectively. What we wanted to do was get into that so-called black box years and decades before cancer would develop, and detect those early changes, those early preclinical changes, signs of damage and increased risk, that would allow us to take steps to intervene and prevent the disease.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Pereira, ultimately, what do you think people, consumers, should be doing to protect themselves?
Well, the good news is that it's good news in the sense that these exposures are inherently preventable. By their nature, we can do things about them. The smoking issue, we know a lot about how people should not smoke, about the programs available. Perhaps what people are not so aware of is the importance of not smoking around children, pregnant women, others, period. That sidestream smoke is very harmful. In terms of air pollution, we can drive more fuel-efficient cars. Governments can require more fuel-efficient cars and trucks, buses. Local communities can control the kinds of buses and trucks and other kinds of pollution that are sited there. And, of course, the federal government has the responsibility to regulate and control the sources of combustion, such as power plants and industrial sources. and very importantly, to encourage renewable sources of energy. On pesticides, people can do a lot in their own homes by not using toxic sprays, turning to safer alternatives that are commercially available. And our website does have information on these things that people can do.
And what we can do is link our website to your website.
Perfect.
So that people can look into that.
Perfect.
Dr. Pereira, thank you so much.
A pleasure.
Dr. Federico Pereira is a professor of environmental health at Columbia University and the director of the Columbia Center for Children's Environmental Health. She was in our New York studio.